Emerson's concept of the over soul. 297. 298 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy inspired Emerson to pen these words, "The soul looked steady, leaf forward, creating a world always before her, and leaving worlds always behind her. She has no dates, no rights, nor persons, nor specialties, nor men. The soul knows only the soul. All else is idle weeds for her wearing." We now turn to a more detailed consideration of the intrinsic nature of the soul and the position it occupies in the composite structures of both man and the universe. As already defined, the soul is the first and chief of the generations. It abides in its own essence at the apex of the pyramid of form. If the soul, then, be a generation and not an eternal principle, of what is it generated and why is it superior to other generations? That which is generated receives its life from another. Having had this active agent once imparted to it, it is thence forth capable of separation therefrom. On the other hand, an ungenerated being, because its life is inherent, must ever abide in that life and that life in it, and hence is incapable of dissolution. Being a generation, the soul must consequently be included under the classification of bodies. Yet it is different from bodies, for being the chief of them, it possesses a fullness of virtues which exceeds the fullness of any other body. Of inferiors, then, the soul is the superior, and by virtue of its disposition occupies a midmost place between abiding life and unabiding form. As the physical man is clothed in a vehicle composed of the objectification and substantial counter part of his superphysical corporeal impulses, so an invisible body generated of attributes too subtle to assume physical aspect envelops the spiritual part as with an appropriate robe. Virtue, for example, is irreducible to physical perceptions. Seated, however, in the invisible nature, it manifests as an intangible and definite attribute of the self. Man is as surely clothed in the garments of virtue as he is in the garments of the physical. They are vehicles of his expression no less real than are the members formed of bone, flesh, or sinew. Besides the physical, man is the owner of many bodies, invisible however to those whose perceptions are limited solely to the earthly senses. Each of these bodies is the vehicle of definite potentialities which are slowly being manifested through appropriate organisms. Man lives in many worlds simultaneously, but of this fact he is unaware until he comes to realize that every phase of his temperament attunes him to a different level of universal activity. A concatenated chain of vehicles extends upward from the dense physical organism to the attenuated superphysical organism of the soul. These bodies originally issued forth from the soul and to the soul. They must return, or rather, we should say their essences verge. For soul existed before bodies and shall endure after bodies have ceased to be. Yet the soul is profoundly influenced by its bodies, and its nature is subjected to change by the reactions of bodily conditions. As the proper monad of bodies, the soul causes to issue out from its own being all that is inferior to itself. And by the same course that dominated their issuance, the soul reabsorbs these self-same bodies back again into its own essence, for by this reabsorption is the perfection of bodies consummated. Man cannot enter into the presence of reality while still invested with body, for body can never contemplate the bodiless, form the formless, or the generated the ungenerated. As bodies, forms, and generations are thus transmuted into soul, more correctly, reabsorbed into the soul substance, man creates for himself a new and more subtle garment, a luminous sheath, a bodiless body, a form verging toward the formless, by which it is enabled to contemplate formlessness with comprehension. The soul, then, is the all-sufficient body. It is form elevated to the vanishing point, it is nature retired into its own apex and thus rendered capable of contemplating its own cause. Through progressive sublimation, bodies are caused to retire from their own materiality and incline themselves toward that spirituality from which they derived their actuating principle. If the fruitage of physical experience were apprehensible by the physical nature alone, then life would be but a span of useless suffering, for the deed would perish with the doer, and the self be left as impecunious as before. Though every tangible evidence of physical achievement must be discarded, Emerson's concept of the Oversoul, 299. 300 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. By the decarnating spirit, yet there is carried forward into the invisible a subtle substance or pabulum extracted from incident and assimilable by the soul nature. Every incident, every experience, every conclusion of the physical life has its own soul nature, to be extracted therefrom by a strange distillation. The vapors thus distilled are inhaled by the soul even as the physical body subsists upon the material atmosphere. The distilled essence of incident thus becomes the essential nutriment of the soul, and the experiences of life are ultimately metamorphosed into soul qualities, becoming psychical urges and influences by which the outer nature is inclined hither and thither. As polarity exists throughout the sphere of generation, it follows that the soul itself, though intrinsically a monad, must manifest through the duad the positive and negative channels of expression. The soul is accordingly symbolized as two creatures, one a beautiful and radiant spirit subsisting upon the manifesting virtues of the life, the other an evil and rebellious spirit fostered by every unworthy thought or deed. These two guard the mystic gate between the outer and the inner self. For, as the soul, they are the portal through which the polar forces of cause and effect pass in mutual exchange. The radiant soul, fashioned from the very substance of achievement, becomes the animating principle of intuition, for what is in tuition but a kind of memory in which particulars are forgotten, but principles remembered? The mind may lack the power to reason through, and the outer nature be uninformed regarding the solution of perplexing problems. But based upon ages of endeavor, intuition unerringly points out the law of probability. For by virtue of ripe experience it inclines with more certitude than the reason, and with more discretion than the thinking. But inexperienced personality, the evil part of the soul, speaks also, and its voice is conscience. Conscience is the still, small voice of unremembered suffering which, long vanished from the conscious mind, yet lives in the deeper recesses of the nature, where it warns of impending catastrophe and whispers to such as will listen the standards of right and wrong as established by experience. Men and women of normal intelligence never commit wrong deeds which they do not know are wrong before their commission. We may dissemble or feign ignorance, but all too often we realize that we lie even while we speak. The mentor of ages dwells within, and irrespective of our pretensions, its words are audible to our inner selves. What is that accusing self from which the malefactor can never escape and which hounds the evildoer to the bitter end? It is the soul, living its own life consistent with the principle of truth. The soul will never let us rest until our outer lives are rendered harmonious with the code within. Why are some happy, though surrounded by all manner of misfortune and sorely oppressed by offending circumstances? Because the soul, satisfied with the behavior of the life, bestows the sense of satisfaction upon these outer sensibilities so keenly vexed by an unkind providence. The all-sufficing realization of accomplishment flows from the soul, and like the balm of Gilead assuages the torments of the material Tartarus. The persecuted parts are imbued with fresh courage and conviction, and given new strength to meet every emergency. On the other hand, why are so many who are fully blessed with this world's goods, and possessors of all that should bestow happiness and tranquility so miserable, so abject, so afraid? Because the soul, dissatisfied, refuses to allow an outer complacency to silence its accusations. When man's soul thus convicts him of misdirected living, there is no tribunal to which he can appeal for mitigation of his offense. Shall we then wonder that the Greeks declared conscience to be a daemon that eternally whispers in the ear of the mind, and intuition a guardian deity that can conduct the life through the perils of the physical universe? Intuition and conscience are the tangible expressions of the intangible soul by which man is made to realize that from every act a residue remains, which shall influence his doing unto the end of time. Nothing that we accomplish is lost, nothing that we achieve is forgot. 10. For while the particulars may vanish away, the principles involved are interwoven into the fabric of an invisible vestment. Emersonconcept of Theo Versal 301. 302 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. That clothes the self in the ample folds of experience, and ensures that spirit shall never be without a counselor, or life without a patron. We have already set forth the triform constitution of the divine agent who through the one, the beautiful, and the good creates, preserves, and destroys the innumerable orders of beings. Apuleius, in the Metamorphosis, sets forth in allegorical terms the inner mystery of the soul. The legend of Cupid and Psyche existed, however, prior to the time of Apuleius, being preserved inviolate by the philosophers lest a profane world desecrate the sacred truths. A king and queen had three daughters, so the story goes, of whom the youngest, Psyche, was of such surpassing beauty that mortals paid her a homage that elevated her above the dignity of even Venus herself, the indignant goddess of beauty. Thereupon dispatched her winged son, Cupid, to humble the pride of Psyche by infusing her with a passion for some gross and unnatural being. Invisible to mortals, Cupid entered the apartment of Psyche to carry out his mother's mission, but became so enamored of the beautiful maiden that he repented of his role and schemed to win Psyche for himself. Suffering from the enmity of Venus, Psyche found no love among mankind, and in obedience to an oracle which declared that she would never be the bride of a mortal lover but that her husband would be a monster whom neither gods nor man could resist, she ascended the mountain upon which it was decreed she should await the coming of her unnatural bridegroom. As she stood upon the mountain top, the god Zephyr picked her up and bore her into a flowery flill, in the midst of which stood a grove of tall and stately trees and a magnificent palace which was not the work of mortal hands. The palace roof was supported by gilded columns, and the walls were ornamented with tracing of beasts and strange creatures. Vast treasures of gold and jewels were also gathered there, and Psyche was served by invisible attendants who greatly defied her slightest wish.